Today's Teisho will be on case 23 in the Heikigan Roku, in the Mumonkan. Case 23 in the Mumonkan is entitled Think Neither Good Nor Evil. The sixth ancestor was pursued by the monk Myo as far as Taiyu Mountain. The patriarch, the ancestor, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it away, take it now." Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge. Faltering and trembling, he cried out, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, please give me instruction." The ancestor said, "Think neither good nor evil. At this very moment, what is the original self of monk Myo?" At these words, Myo was directly illuminated. His whole body was covered with sweat. He wept and bowed, saying, "Besides the secret words and the secret meaning you have just now revealed to me, is there anything else deeper still?" The ancestor said, "What I have told you is no secret at all. When you look into your own true self, whatever is deeper is found right there." Myo said, "I was with the monks under Obi for many years, but could not realize this true self. But now, receiving your instruction, I know it is like a man drinking water and knowing whether it is cold or warm. My lay brother, you are now my teacher." The ancestor said, "If you say so, but let's both call Obi our teacher. Be mindful to treasure and hold fast to what you have attained." Mumon's comment, the sixth ancestor, Weineng, was, so to speak, hurried into helping a person in an emergency, and he displayed a grandmotherly kindness. It is as though he peeled a fresh lychee, removed the seed, put it in your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. Mumon's verse, "You cannot describe it, you cannot picture it, you cannot admire it. Don't try to eat it raw. Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed." So, there's a little bit of a backstory to this. We came into this particular koan sort of in the middle of the story. And so it might not have made much sense. The backstory is that there was a Zen temple, and Obi was the abbot. And Obi was basically quite a successful Zen abbot. He had a large temple with lots of students. Is somebody's phone on?
Sorry.
He had a large temple with lots of students, and basically he was a very highly admired teacher. So he realized that he was going to die, and he had to determine who he was going to put in his place as the abbot of the temple. So he asked all of his students to write a poem that would reflect their state of mind as they were doing their Zen practice. One of his students was a very gifted person And everybody assumed he was going to be the abbot, the next abbot. And he wrote a beautiful poem, and all the poems were supposed to be put on pillars in the Dharma Hall. So each monk wrote a poem that would basically express his state of mind. So, one monk wrote a poem that said, "My mind was very agitated today, but after three periods of sitting, I'm a little calmer." Yeah, and that would be good. One person might have said, "When I was sitting today, I was thinking about lunch. When will it come?" Right? Okay. Now we know these people aren't going to be the abbot of the temple, but this would be an honest statement of where their mind was, right? Somebody else might have written a poem that said, "Tried to sit today, but was too distracted." Somebody else might have written a poem that said, so on. But some people at the temple had practiced Zen for a long time and were able to enter deep samadhi. So somebody might have said, "Very quiet today, mind very still, listening to the sound of the wind." You know, and somebody else might have written a poem that said, "A blank mind, deep blankness for the second sit, third sit, less deep." You know, something like that. So all the monks had to write a poem that expressed basically what was happening to them on the cushion. And there was the lead monk, the head monk, was also going to write a poem, and he wrote a beautiful poem. He said, "The mind is like a mirror, and it collects dust, and we have to do zazen to wipe the dust away." See, all the monks and nuns at the temple, when they looked at all the poems, they could see that this guy's poem was just so good, right? That isn't that true, you know? We all have to do our zazen. We all have to do our zazen because as we're going through the week, we pick up dust. We pick up dust. You know, sometimes when you come in here to do meditation, you'll notice that your mind is not clear. You bring things with you. So if you had a difficult week, if you had a stressful week, you sit down on the cushion, and you begin to like clean the dust off this beautiful luminous mirror, which is your mind. And maybe after two sits and some walking meditation, your mind is more clear, and you feel better. Sometimes it's harder to get to that place, but one way to think about Zen practice is that we're doing this. You know, we all get dust on our mirrors. I hope you won't mind my saying this, but I noticed today that somebody was actually checking the internet during the sitting period. And this isn't the first time. You know, I can open my eyes and there's like a mysterious light in the zendo. And it's like, what? You know, is it a miracle? No. It's somebody checking their telephone or their... their internet. And, if I may say so, please accept this as a loving comment. But this is an addiction, yes? Definitely. Absolutely true. This is addiction. This is the face of addiction, right? I mean, if you can't sit for an hour and a half without checking the internet, you are truly addicted. And please hear me, because it's coming from a loving place, you know? Our society is not a healthy society. It's not. And people think they're connected on the internet, but actually they're disconnecting, right? I mean, the internet does connect us in some ways. The other day I was writing something, and I was stuck. I couldn't remember who said something. So I just Googled it, and like that, I found the author. Now, in the old days, when I was young, you'd have to go to the library and search and search. You'd write your friends and say, "Do you remember where this was? What Shakespeare play or something?" And so hopefully somebody would. Now we have Google. We can just Google it, and there it is. You know. But on the other hand, you know, so much, you know, we're connected all the time. Information is pouring in all the time. But we're not able to access it because we're distracted. We're distracted. The truth is, there's more information than we can process. But we're very, very distracted in the 21st century. And we don't pay attention, or we can't focus enough on the moment to begin to experience all the information that's coming in. So, you know, the internet feels like it's connecting, but in my opinion, it's very disconnecting. It's very disconnecting. And it's very addictive. I know this from my own experience. So, you know, when we come into the Zendo and we sit all morning, you know, you might begin to have this craving, like, I've got to get online. Who could be emailing me right now, you know? And you'll look at your emails, and it's an email saying, special travel deal, something you don't care about at all. But we have this nagging feeling that something is important is happening somewhere else, you know. And this is what one form of what the Buddha called, you could say craving, you know. Craving is not a healthy mindset, you know. So the in some ways the internet encourages a craving mindset. So I'm not trying to give you a hard time if you were online in the Zendo, but it is an example of how we cultivate these mental habits that cause us suffering, you know. There's a lot of research that suggests that things like Facebook don't make people happier. You know, going out to Facebook actually has many negative psychological consequences. People feel lonely, they go to Facebook, and then after they close it out, they actually feel lonelier because it feels like all their friends are doing these exciting things and you're sitting in your room. So there is a real truth to this idea that we cultivate these mental habits that are really bad for us. And, you know, when we come in to do zazen and we sit on the cushion and we watch the breath, it's a little bit like deconditioning. So, you know, if you're a smoker, you know, having to sit for an hour and a half without a cigarette can be agony. But after a while, if you keep doing that, you know, you stop craving a cigarette, and, you know, when you're free from craving for a cigarette, that's actually very liberating. It's a very beautiful feeling to be free of that craving. And the internet is like that too. You know, at first it's very uncomfortable to go for an hour and a half without texting, especially if our mind is quote-unquote bored. You know, boredom is a very interesting phenomenon. I want you to know that I have been doing zazen for almost 40 years. And I do this pretty much every day. And I don't even know what boredom is anymore. I'm not boasting. I'm telling you the truth. Something interesting is happening all the time. You know, just the sound of the wind is absolutely thrilling, or can be if your mind is really open. But when we're in the mindset of craving, we want something, and everything else we're getting seems valueless and unimportant, you know. So it's like dying of thirst, and you're standing in a beautiful pool of water. You know, this is the human condition. So anyway, this poem that said the mind is like a mirror that we have to clear, and we have to clear the dust away, has great truth. Everybody thought at the temple that this poem about this mirror, the mind is like a mirror and we have to clear the dust away, was the best poem that any of the monks wrote, see. But in the kitchen, there was a worker. He wasn't even a monk. His name was Wei Nong. And Wei Nong was an illiterate woodcutter who had come to work at the temple and was allowed to prepare rice for everybody to eat. Nobody understood who Wei Nang was, anybody. They just thought he was this dumb little nobody in the kitchen. But he couldn't write, but he asked one of the monks, he said, "Well, listen, I understand that there's a contest, and everybody should describe what happens to their minds when they meditate. And I'd like to write a poem too." And the person working in the kitchen laughed and said, "Oh, okay, Wei Nang, you can enter too, you know. I can't imagine you have anything interesting to say, you know, since you aren't a monk, etc., etc." But actually, he wrote a poem that said, you know, the mind is not really like a mirror, and there really isn't any dust. From the beginning, emptiness, emptiness. And they put that on the pillar too. So anyway, when the time came for the abbot to evaluate Obai, as he's called in Japanese, he had to go up and down in the Dharma Hall and look at all the poems on the pillars. And some of the poems said, "Sleepy today, hard to get into samadhi." One of the poems said, "Needed to text. Secretly texted." Another poem said, "Wish I had a smoke. Why did I throw my cigarettes away?" You know, and we work our way up the pillars, and we get to a place that says, "The mind is like a mirror. We clear away the dust." And then there's this poem that says, "The mind is not a mirror. There's no mirror, and there's no dust. From the beginning, from the beginning, emptiness." See, and okay, so. Obai comes up, he looks at all the different poems, and then he goes back into his room. And everybody's a little surprised because they thought he was going to go, "And now I am going to announce the winner. The winner is the head monk for his beautiful poem about the mirror-like mind and the dust." But he doesn't. He goes back into his room, and there's no announcement of the winner. See. Anyway, Wei Nang is in the kitchen, room in the kitchen where he sleeps, and a monk comes in and wakes him up at night and says, "Obai wants to talk to you. Obai wants to talk to you." And Wei Nang says, "Me? Really?" So the monk brings Wei Nang to Obai. And Obai has never been in the abbot's room, but he hasn't even been allowed in most of the monasteries. So he's brought into this rather nice room where Obai lives, the abbot of the temple. And Obai says, "Are you the author of that poem?" And Wei Nang says, "Yes, I am." And Obai says, "You have the deepest understanding of Buddhism, of Zen, of awakened mind, basically." And he says, "I received this robe from my teacher, who received it from his teacher, who received it from basically Bodhidharma. And I'm giving you the robe now. And I'm giving you the begging bowl that Bodhidharma brought with him from China, from India. See? So I'm giving you Bodhidharma's robe, and I'm giving you his bowl. And you are my Dharma heir. I'm acknowledging you as as authorized to teach in our lineage." And then he says, "But Wei Nang, you have to leave right now. You have to go tonight." And he says, "Because you know what? Nobody in this temple is going to believe that you're deeply awake." And he said, "They might even kill you." Well, I threw that in there for dramatic effect.
It doesn't really say that,
but it makes it more dramatic. So he said, "You've got to go. Because they'll never accept your leadership." See, in the middle of the night, Wei Nang takes his backpack, puts the robe in, puts the ball in, and heads out. In the morning, everybody is still waiting for the announcement, and it doesn't come. And the monks begin to mutter amongst themselves and say, "What happened to Wei Nang? You know, he's gone. And the robe is gone, and the bowl is gone," which are usually like on display or something. And this guy Myo, monk Myo, decides that scoundrel Wei Nung has stolen the bowl and the robe and taken them out of the temple. See, and so he decides to track down Wei Nung and get them back, because that's the most important thing to him, right? Is these symbols of enlightenment or symbols of authority or the temple. So he used to be a general. He's a retired military man who's become a monk. And he tracks, Wei Nung was really moving fast, going through the countryside, but he tracks Wei Nung all the way to this spot, see? And Wei Nung is like washing his face or something, and he's left the robe and the bowl next to the waterfall, next to the water. And Monk Myo sneaks down and tries to pick them up, but he can't pick them up. And he wants to, but he can't pick them up. And when he realizes I can't pick these off the ground, he breaks into sweat, right? And he it doesn't make any sense. It's like, this is just, I'm a strong man. This is a robe. This is a bowl. Why can't I lift these up? And he has like a little nervous breakdown right there, because something strange is happening. So let me just go back to the story. The sixth patriarch was pursued by the Monk Myo. See, the sixth ancestor is Wei Nung. Wei Nung was pursued by Monk Myo as far as Tai Yu Shan. The patriarch, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and the bowl on the rock and said, "This robe represents the faith. It should not be fought over." So basically, it says, Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge, faltering and trembling. So, he tries to get it, pick it off the ground, and he can't do it. And he has like a little nervous breakdown. And he suddenly says, "Who are you? What's going on?" You see, and this is a very important moment in Zen. You could say Zen history. A very famous story in Zen tradition, but it's also a very important sort of description of a person's psychological transformation, basically. Monk Myo is somebody who lives in ordinary sort of ordinary world, right? He has dreams and aspirations. He is living in a monastery. His goal is to wake up, right? So he goes to this monastery. His goal is enlightenment. Maybe he's third in line. There's the head monk, there's another monk, and there's Monk Myo. Monk Myo is trying to work his way up the hierarchy. He wants to be a leader in the community. He's a retired military man. And he's living this life of like a competitive striving, maybe. Maybe he does everything right, so when he gets up in the morning, he's always first in the zendo. He has his robes folded perfectly. He's well-trained, well-disciplined person. But all his life, he's living in conventional sort of thinking, sort of self-centered thinking, ordinary consciousness, see? And so when Wei Nung disappears with the robe and the bowl, he reaches a logical, rational conclusion. He stole it, right? And I have to get it back. And so he follows Wei Nung into the forest, into the wilderness, and has this confrontation. But at this point, something very strange happens to Myo, right? And this is really important, because this is really sometimes we get out of our ordinary everyday consciousness, which is very self-centered, and we realize that we have depths of our minds possess a depth that we hardly even suspected. I hope this is making some sense. Every once in a while, we encounter deeper parts of ourself that we have closed off or prevented ourselves from seeing, And we actually work very, very hard to prevent ourselves from encountering these deeper parts of ourself, which are really often unconscious, the unconscious depths in ourself. You know, we do a lot of maintenance to make sure that our everyday world is very controllable, very predictable, very safe, and actually rather empty, often, rather empty, you know, lifeless and empty. You know, we work very hard to make our lives routine and to make everything predictable and to build a world that will be comfortable for our small, rational self. This is just who we are. You know, so, you know, you can get up, you know, you get up and go to your job, you come home, you know, maybe you like to mow the lawn, maybe you don't, you know, this can be your life, right? And, you know, maybe there are things you like. You say, oh, beer, I like beer. You can have a beer after you mow the lawn. Or maybe you don't like beer. Or maybe you like one brand of beer but not another. So if somebody buys you the wrong brand of beer, you get upset. And if it's the right brand of beer, it's like, ah, just the beer I wanted, right? Maybe you like to watch a football game. So, you know, you watch a football game, you drink your beer, this is great. You know, you live like this for 80 years. If you're lucky, you die in your bed. And that's okay. But, you know, we have capacities and we have worlds inside of us that we don't normally access, but which are quite wonderful and amazing, you know. If you think about consciousness itself, you know, consciousness is quite vast. You know, the human has at his or her disposal many, many different states of mind that we don't normally access. You know, we stay in, if you think of a consciousness as like a spectrum or like a bandwidth, right? We stay in a very narrow area on that vast spectrum, and we live our lives there pretty much unless something jolts us out of it, you know? And as a result, you know, the human being is like an iPod that's used for a doorstop, yeah? You know, we have these amazing capacities that we never actualize or tap or get access to because of the way we live, right? And the way we live is mostly like maintaining our everyday reality, you know? And that's important because if you have something that's terrifying to you, you know, you want to get back to normal. We say get back to normal, right? You have a car accident, that's very jolting. Somebody hits you on the highway, that's very jolting. You want to get back to normal. That makes sense. If you get sick, you know, you get a diagnosis of some serious problem, you want to get back to normal. Normal can be precious, I understand. But human beings have these depths that they don't normally tap. And what happened to Monk Myo is that he was living this kind of like, dreamlike existence of normal, the normal, right? And, you know, his life was like everybody else's life. It was, how can I be happy? How can I be safe? And as a result, you know, his life was kind of impoverished, actually. He hears about the robe and the ball. He assumes that Wei Neng is just like him, you know. Basically, somebody who would steal something like this and run away with it. And so he follows Wei Neng, and then he has this little experience of like a, it's like an eruption from the unconscious into the conscious mind. It's like, if I can put it that way, it's like, he's going to take this bowl off the ground and this robe, and suddenly it's like the unconscious reaches into his, out of a force emerges from the unconscious and possesses his body, so to speak. You know. And if you think about it, that is what we're, you know, that's really what we're doing when we do zazen, believe it or not. You know, so one way to think about zazen is that we're simply doing this to be calm, to tranquilize ourselves. So, you know, after a stressful week, you might come into the Zendo or do Zen at home, and you sit down and you watch your breath for 25 minutes, and at the end of it, you're calmer than you were. See? And that's excellent. You know, if you do that every day, you will be a healthier, happier person. And I highly recommend it. That's sort of like a daily maintenance meditation practice. Basically, it takes about 15 or 20 minutes to begin to relax. So if you do meditation half an hour a day, the first 15 or 20 minutes are really just learning how to relax. And around 15 minutes in, you'll have a deep relaxation response. You know, if there were some wires hooked up to your skin and your muscles and your brain, all of these lines would change. You know, basically, your skin softens, the electrical system in your body starts functioning differently. Your brain, you flip into a different brain wave. You feel more calm and relaxed. This is very healthy and very good. But it's really only a small part of what Zen is about. So I'm not criticizing anybody who's practicing just to have sort of like mental health. You know, so come home, do half an hour of meditation, you're better, less stress. And that's much better than having a drink. It's much better than, watching 3 hours of television to escape from your problems. You know, it's therapeutic in all kinds of ways, so that's great. But if you just practice that way, it's kind of a missed opportunity, really. If you just use Zen or meditation to maintain your sort of like status quo, you are missing an opportunity for a deeper life, I would say. So I'm not criticizing people who meditate half an hour every day. I think that's exemplary. And I'm just saying life could be bigger than that. You know, just maintaining the life we live is okay, but there are depth worlds inside of us that we don't normally tap. So, you know, if you come to Zazen on a Saturday, you're doing more than just maintaining, right? This is more than like maintaining. This is like challenging, right? Some of you came here today at 7 o'clock. And so by the end of the day, you will have been sitting for like 5 hours with some little breaks. And that's a lot of meditation, and it's challenging. You know, the goal is not just maintaining. The goal is to tap these deeper parts of ourselves that we don't normally get access to. In Zen, we have this concept of a Buddha mind. And we believe that, you know, at the bottom of the mind, at the bottom of the unconscious mind is this enlightened intelligence. This enlightened intelligence. And basically, we don't usually get access to this for all kinds of complicated reasons. You know, partly we're afraid of getting outside of the norm, right? You know, we create this reality. It works for us, right? You know, as we're growing up, we sort of create a world for ourselves, a sort of everyday world, and it works for us, and we maintain it. Unless we begin to have, say, psychological problems or health problems, we pretty much stay there. But, you know, often we wind up very safe, but we also wind up a little bit isolated. Our life can feel a little bit unsatisfactory because something seems to be missing. You know, this ordinary, everyday way of living is okay, but it's a little bit disconnected. You know, every once in a while, people do things to get out of that ordinary, everyday consciousness. You know, so This summer, for example, I went hiking in eastern Oregon. And I was in a totally new place, and I was up in these mountains, and it was exciting. It was unfamiliar. I was sleeping on rocks every night. You know, I have an air mattress, but it doesn't really work that well, you know, and it was uncomfortable, and I got wet in the rain, and at the end of it, I was pretty happy because I had gotten outside of my little safety zone, you know. And so we all do this. We all recognize, you know, this is okay, but something's missing. But Zen is like that too, maybe even more dramatically. You know, inside of you, the Zen view is that inside of you is a Buddha, is Buddha. And we need to get access to that, you know, basically. And the way we get access to that is sort of like stepping out of our normal reality. And we do it in a very guided, highly structured way. But that's really what we're doing. And, you know, people find this very hard to believe, you know. I think people, you know, if I say meditation will help you to get calm, people believe me. If I say meditation will improve your respiratory rate and your pulse, they believe me. But if I say to people, you know, there is actually a Buddha trapped inside of you trying to get out, that just sounds like bullshit to a lot of people, you know. But it's the view. It's the Buddhist view. And I would say it's the truth. You know. People, when people look at somebody like the Dalai Lama, you know, they say, you know, I myself have met the Dalai Lama. He doesn't know my name, but I've met him. And he came to sit at our Zen center many, many years ago. And he is a truly genuine, loving person. And he sort of radiates sort of like love. You know, it's quite remarkable. And when people meet him, there are absolutely many people I know who are like cynics, fall in love with the Dalai Lama. I actually have a friend of mine who's a Marxist in my department. And I don't, you know, he's a wonderful guy, but you would think a Marxist, you know, would not be a fan of the Dalai Lama. And he actually, you know, is very much into revolution, and he admires Lenin to some degree, you know, who was a pretty tough customer. So he's a Marxist, but he loves the Dalai Lama. And he was telling me the other day, I didn't realize he had this side, but he's pretty much in love with the Dalai Lama. So the Dalai Lama can even get to these people who are kind of like hard-bitten cynics or materialists. And so when we see the Dalai Lama, we understand, you know, he is a fully realized person, you know, or a very deeply realized person, and we admire that. But we don't necessarily think that could be us, right? Don't necessarily think that could be us. And I'm not talking about thinking there would be thousands of adoring crowds looking at us. I mean, we don't necessarily believe that innocence or that radiant kindness and compassion is inside us. That seems kind of hard to believe. But actually, it's there. That's the Buddhist view. That's the Zen view. So, you know, we do our best in a way to sort of not encounter the deeper parts of ourself. We create an everyday world which is very demanding. You know, people are busy, busy, busy. And when we're not busy, we fill it up with busyness. You know, we find ways to be busy. You know, that's our modern life. But Myo, maybe he was busy too. You know, when you saw Myo, he had a little calendar, a computer calendar, and he said, what are you doing on Tuesday? Can we go to lunch? Let me check. Nope, sorry. Wednesday? Nope, sorry. How about Friday at 2:30? Okay, you know. So that was his world too, right? So anyway, he goes after Wei Ning, and he's shocked because all of a sudden there's like a little eruption from his unconscious, you know. All of a sudden he does this very strange thing. It's like the unconscious takes control of his body, and he can't lift this robe in the bowl, and he suddenly has like a little breakdown, you know. So. Zen is basically trying to get access to, it's a way of getting access to these deeper parts of ourself, and especially this part of our mind, which is this radiant, compassionate mind. And so, this is a moment where somebody, this monk Myo, has sort of like his first little breakthrough experience. In Zen, we call this, we have a word for this breakthrough experience. We call it Kensho. And that's where the conscious mind, sort of like a hole opens up, a hole, H-O-L-E, opens up in the conscious mind. And this deeper unconscious mind emerges or reaches through that hole into your life, right? And this is a moment where that happens. And our word in Zen for this is Kensho. So, you know, every once in a while, if you practice Zen a lot, you will have a Kensho experience, you know? And these can be small, or they can be fairly large. You know, sometimes people go to Sesshin and, they're suddenly taking a break and sitting on a bench outside of the building, and they suddenly feel like they have no self at all. And everything they hear is crisp and clear, and, they hear wind, and it feels like it's coming out of their own bodies. That's not such an unusual experience. This is called a Kensho. It's like this bigger mind, the little mind, or the conscious mind, opens up, and we begin to experience the world in this different way that is more integrated, where the different parts of ourselves, the conscious and the unconscious mind, are more fully integrated. Yeah? And then we may close up a little bit. We may close up. In Zen, you might come to a Saturday sit, and you leave here, and all of a sudden you feel so open and spontaneous, you know, and this could happen. Or if you come to Sesshin, around day three of Sesshin, you suddenly feel like you're completely empty, and everything is flowing through you, and you're connected to everything around you. You know, this is Kensho. And then, people close up a little bit, right? You know, you come back to your regular life and your regular habits, and pretty soon you're craving the internet again, you know. But we keep opening up and closing up and opening up and closing up. This is sort of the rhythm of Zen practice. And if you open up enough, you know, you really are transformed by this experience of the deeper parts of your own mind, deeper parts of yourself. And in Zen, you know, one way to think about Zen practice is that we're sitting on the cushion and we're working very hard. We're working very hard, and that's definitely part of the picture. So, you know, if you came here today at 7 o'clock, by the third sit of the second session, you know, you are probably really having to watch your breath and work very hard to maintain your concentration. So there is a dimension of hard work in Zen practice, no question about it. But on the other hand, you know, you're also waiting for something to happen. You know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath or you're calling Mu, you're waiting for a deeper activation to occur. There's a deep, it's like on the surface, nothing seems to be happening, but under the surface of your conscious mind, all this energy is gathering. This force or energy is gathering. It's going to break through into your conscious life. This is sort of the rhythm of Zen practice. So it's like we're gathering this energy, unconscious energy, and finally there's an opening. It breaks through, there's an opening, and our experience is changed, see. Now, you know, sometimes people have these spontaneously, believe it or not. Sometimes people have what are called spontaneous Kenshos. This really happens. So a number of years ago, a Zen student came here, a person came here, and he told me that he had had this experience in college, and he described it to me, and it sounded like he didn't take drugs, he just had this spontaneous experience that sounded like a deep Kensho experience. And I said, well, how do you feel now? And this was a number of years ago. And he said, well, I remember it. You know, I remember it. And I thought that was an interesting thing to say because, you know, it didn't really change his life too much, right? He'd had this experience that was sort of, as we call, a spontaneous kensho, accidental kensho. It happens. And then, you know, he went back to his regular life. He finished college. He has a job. He does a little sitting once in a while. It's like there was this opening and it closed up. You know, so, you know, some people think Zen is all about having kensho, having this kensho experience. But actually, you know, you will have, if you practice Zen long enough, you'll have many kensho experiences. Many openings. Many opening experience, many experiences of opening up. And this happens again and again. And, you know, enlightenment is not something we really achieve. That's a big myth. You know, so, I finally had an enlightenment experience. Enlightenment is not something you can achieve or you can obtain. You have to become enlightenment. See, it's not something you get, it's something you become, you could say. So, you know, this spontaneous kensho that this young man had didn't really change too much. It was like an opening into Buddha mind, Buddha nature, but then he, you know, it was like back to normal, right? So he wasn't really ready for it, and he wasn't really changed by it. So, you know, part of Zen practice is preparing for awakening, and being ready for it when it happens. You know, so we're changing ourselves all the time. You know, every time you sit down on the cushion, you're developing patience, you're developing a tolerance for uncertainty, you're developing a kindness, actually, to yourself and to others. You know, you're changing yourself every time you sit in many different ways. You're learning how to postpone gratification, which is a very good lesson. So all the time we're practicing Zen, we're changing ourselves, we're working on ourselves. And, you know, at some point, you know, there is this opening. And then it closes up. And then there's another one. And then it closes up. But little by little, we're transforming ourselves. We're making ourselves into enlightenment. Enlightenment is not something you have. It's something you have to become. It's something you are. You are. When we meet the Dalai Lama, I don't think he's faking it. I think he's pretty much had many of those opening experiences over and over again. And what we see, I think, is pretty much what we get. It's what the real person is like. This very genuinely open person who has encountered this deeper part of himself and has now really become it. Become it. The sixth ancestor, Wei Nang, the illiterate woodcutter, was pursued by Monk Myo as far as Taiyu Shan, Taiyu Mountain. The ancestor, Wei Nang, seeing Myo coming, laid the robe and the bowl on a rock and said, "This robe just represents the Dharma. It should not be fought over. If you want to take it, take it. It's just a robe." Myo tried to move it, but it was as heavy as a mountain and would not budge. So he has this opening up experience. Faltering, and he has a recognition, you know, faltering and trembling, he cried out, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, what do you know that I don't know? You know, you obviously know something. What do you know?" And Wei Nang says, "Inside of yourself is Buddha nature. Inside of yourself is Buddha nature." At those words, when he says this, Myo looks into his own mind and sees it clearly right there and was directly illuminated. His whole body was covered with sweat. He wept and he vowed, saying, besides the secret words and the secret meanings you have just revealed to me. He said, nobody ever told me about this. I've been in the temple for 20 years and nobody ever said, look inside yourself, Buddha nature is right there. I've been reciting sutras, I've been doing rituals, I've been doing zazen, but nobody ever told me, look inside yourself. So besides the secret teaching, is there anything deeper? And Wei Neng said, what I told you just now isn't a secret at all. It's just not conscious. It's in the unconscious part of yourself. When you look into your own true self, whatever is enlightened is right there. Myo said, I was with the monks under Obai for many years but could not find this. But now, receiving your instruction, I know what reality, I've tasted enlightened mind. It's not a concept anymore for me. It's like when you drink water, you know in your, you know, from your own mouth whether it's hot or cold. He says, so he says, my lay brother, you are now my teacher. So Wei Neng, remember, wasn't a monk. He was just a laborer in the temple. So the monk says, you are my lay brother, but you're my teacher. And Wei Neng says, look, he says, oh, let's say Obai is our teacher. Be mindful of what you of this Buddha nature in yourself and hold fast to what you have attained. Mumon's comment, the sixth ancestor was, so to speak, hurried into helping a man in an emergency, and he displayed a grandmotherly kindness. It was as though he had peeled a fresh lychee, removed the seed, put it in your mouth, and asked you to swallow it down. Mumon's verse, you cannot describe it, you cannot picture it, you cannot admire it. Don't try to eat it raw. In other words, it's below the threshold of your conscious mind. You have to sit in mushin, in blankness, and wait for it to arise. Okay? Your true self has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it will not be destroyed.